Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and we are going to be playing the second part of my interview with Senator Richard Black, where we talk about the details of what's going on in Syria. We're also going to be talking about Russia, the escalation of tensions there, and how the United States has violated its peace treaty unnecessarily and putting a lot of us, well, everybody at risk. And then we're going to be talking about North Korea a bit. But I want to talk about free speech before I get into the show. I want to tell you this interview that I had up on YouTube is under review for monetization. It was just flagged. And I'm very disappointed because other than it having a different political view, all of this is facts. This is from an expert in the field. He's actually in politics and has a great background. There's no hate speech. There's nothing bullying, nothing bad about anybody other than a different political view and trying to educate people on what he thinks is going on. And so I'm very disappointed in YouTube for having that stance on not just this video, but I've had other videos that the only problem is that maybe someone doesn't agree with the politics of the person that I'm interviewing. And to me, that's very disappointing that we've gotten into this point in our country where somebody's political view is being shut out. That's not what we're about as a country. It's one thing about maybe shutting down hate speech or something that hurts other people. It's another thing when you're shutting down political views. And in this case with Senator Black, people need to know this. We are potentially going to be murdering millions of people, or allowing our actions are going to enable millions of people to be murdered, and they are shutting that down because it's inconvenient truth, I guess. So anyways, I want to get right back into this interview so it can air, the full interview can air. And I just want to, I'll keep you posted on how some of that goes, and hopefully YouTube will pull their, you know, head out of their behind and not be taking away our First Amendment rights. And even the advertisers, shame on them for pulling out just because somebody has a different political view. That's terrible. I would think that these big corporations would support our freedom of speech and our country, you know, make sure we hold up the things that make us what we are, which I don't even know what we are anymore when you start seeing this stuff. So anyways, let's get into this interview with Senator Richard Black.
And gradually they're being squeezed out. They're going to be gone probably in the next 3 months, the last vestiges. What have they done? The Saudi Arabians have ordered Jaish al-Islam to attack ISIS. They've been allies all this time, and all of a sudden the Saudis send down orders, okay, start attacking ISIS. Why? Because I think, you know, President Trump has said, I'm going to attack ISIS, I'm going to defeat ISIS. So he goes to these various countries, he says, I've got to defeat ISIS. I want to be able to say I've done that. We can defeat ISIS, but what about Al-Qaeda? ISIS didn't kill 3,000 Americans on 9/11. That was Al-Qaeda. And now we call them the opposition, or we call them the rebels. CIA has them constantly changing their names so that people can never quite...
Yeah, you don't know who you're... They're all just one big mob of bad people.
Yes, one of the most successful things that the CIA has done in this war is they have said, look, instead of saying, okay, this is one massive army, we're going to chop it up into little pieces to where you've got all of these foreign sounding names. They're constantly changing. That one day they've got one name, the next day they have another name. There are 1,000 different groups. They are all terrorists. They have one singular objective, which is bring down Syria. And when you've brought down Syria, you execute 2 million Christians. You execute 2 million Alawites, who are known as the Friends of the Christians. You begin executing the Shiites, and then you go on to all of the other minorities, including the moderate Sunni rebels. Keep in mind, most of the Syrian army that's fighting this war consists of Sunni soldiers, members of the Syrian armed forces.
So if our side wins, there'll be millions of people slaughtered.
Yes. And Christians in particular, people need to understand this. I've developed a tremendous sympathy for all of them, including the Sunni Muslims, the moderate Sunnis, because they're human beings. And you know, you begin to relate to them. But I think for people on our side, you know, most of whom are Christians or their friends are Christians, the idea of slaughtering 2 million Christians and, you know, having them beheaded, having the women and the little girls sold on slave markets, and the little girls, you know, they're religion under Sharia law, they are permitted to have full, complete sexual relations with a 9-year-old child.
That's terrible.
And they do this. They do this in you know, massively. So is this really what we want? You know, under President Assad, 51% of college graduates in Syria were women.
So we are helping some of the worst regimes take down one of the best regime of the Middle East, that
yes.
that has the standards and things, the ideals that we talk about. So why would we do that? What's our point? World War III? Globalism? We need a central bank there. We need to take him down for that reason.
There are a lot of things at play, but one of the immediate triggers of the war was Saudi Arabia had wanted to run an oil line across Syria into Turkey for many years. They were very frustrated, very angry at the Syrians for not allowing it. In around 2010, Qatar, which is a satellite of Saudi Arabia, asked to run a major gas line there, because Qatar is essentially a gas field with a couple of hotels. And Syria did not give them permission to run the gas line. Within days, Qatar and Saudi Arabia began pouring money into these faux rebel organizations. They weren't real. They were, you know, you had deserters from the army, people who thought, okay, the United States is going to collapse the government. I want to be on the winning side. I'm going to get something out of it. So, but you had Saudi Arabia and Qatar pouring money in. Then you had Turkey. Turkey has always had cast a greedy eye on Aleppo. Aleppo is the industrial center of Syria. And so Turkey, now keep in mind, Turkey is where all of the terrorists flow into Syria. Almost all. Now, some of them come in from Jordan, but the vast number come in from Turkey. Turkey was the principal ally of ISIS for about 5 years. Now, it looks like ISIS has sort of run its course, and now they're going to be thrown away after they've all, you know, devoted their lives to this mythical caliphate. But I have spoken to witnesses who stood at superhighways going from Syria into Turkey, and they've said there were hundreds of oil tankers bringing stolen oil from Syria into Turkey. And I asked the question, I said, hundreds in what period of time? And they said, hundreds every day. And I said, are they checked at the border? They're all waved right through the border. And so at one point, there was a fleet of 2,000 oil tankers that was run by ISIS, and it was being sent directly to Turkey, where Turkey was making a huge profit on it. And the U.S. coalition never interfered with this trafficking. When Russia sent its fairly modest expeditionary force, after several weeks, they went in and they destroyed 500 oil tankers in a single day. The ISIS oil people have become so complacent. They knew that the U.S. coalition was never going to touch them. They were untouchable. And all of a sudden, Russia came in and they were slaughtered.
Yeah, they just said enough. It made Russia look like a hero.
Well, and, you know, it's a very interesting thing. People always say, well, Russia's communist. Russia's the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union died with the collapse of the wall. And Russia has emerged a totally new country. One of the things very few people recognize, the Soviet Union, if you practiced Christianity, you could end up dead or sent to Siberia. Christianity is highly encouraged in Russia today, more so than it is in the United States. They actually have military medals that are named after the saints. So this is not the Russia that we were taught to believe in. And NATO wants us to continue to believe that the Soviet Union exists. And the Soviet Union is gone.
Yeah, so why do we keep wanting to perpetuate the Cold War era ideals? What is the benefit? Is it the war or the weapon dealers? I mean, what is it?
The weapons dealers are part of it. There are vast sums of money made in that way. But when you're talking about our conflict with Russia, you know, at the end of the Cold War, you had two great alliances, one the Soviet alliance and one the American alliance, which was NATO. And the Soviets dissolved, the nation, the Soviet Union dissolved. Their defensive alliance dissolved. And at that point, we should have held a great march and ceremony. We should have pinned a medal on every NATO soldier's uniform and said, good work, you've done well, we're sending you home. But we didn't. We kept NATO there, and NATO, now that there was a total vacuum on the former Soviet side, All of the bureaucrats in NATO had to find a reason to exist. And if you do that, you have to have an enemy. You can't have an alliance without an enemy. And so they began to paint Russia as being a whole lot like the Soviet Union. And it's not. And so they began to move constantly, in violation of our solemn agreements with the Soviet Union, we move further and further. And now we're, you know, routinely adding more and more countries to NATO. We're easing ourselves up on the Russian border. And in fact, we're going into the Black Sea with warships. We go right up to the edge of their territorial waters, and then they'll send a jet to swoop in and warn us off. And we say, oh, this is a provocative action on the part of Russia. Well, it isn't a provocative action on their part. It's a provocative action on our part.
So at what point do you think Russia will be, say, this is enough, and they're going to actually act? Or do you think that they won't?
Well, I don't think they will for a certain time. But if we continue the march that we're on right now, at some point we're there and this group of global oligarchs is going to say, we're going to disassemble Russia. And the next thing, we're going to enter into a military conflict with Russia. And I think I understand how President Putin thinks. I remember when Russia fought the war in Chechnya, and they, after several failed attempts, they finally captured Grozny once he took firm control of it. Now, immediately afterwards, there were snipers in the city and this sort of thing. He flew himself in. He was wearing gym shorts and a t-shirt, and he went jogging around the main streets of Grozny, right? I mean, literally, there were still buildings smoldering. And I thought, this is not a guy who is in it for what he can get out of it. This is an extremely courageous guy, whether people like it or not. He's a gutsy guy. You don't go jogging in Grozny right after it's been captured if you're not prepared to get shot. And he did this, and he is very much a patriot. And I'll tell you what, if we push to the point where we invade Russia, which could happen at the rate we're going, he's the kind of guy who might very well say, you know what? If they are going to destroy Russia, we're all going down in a ball of flame.
They'd rather go down than have us take them over.
I believe that's the case. I was a forward air controller, and I fought with the 1st Marine Regiment on the ground in Vietnam, and I had declared I was never going to be captured alive. And I used to go deep into enemy territory, sometimes with very small patrols. I had decided if we ever get cornered, you've only got so much ammunition. They outnumbered us by thousands. And this was not going to be Custer's last stand. The final order that I gave over the air was going to be, I want you to drop napalm and we're going to pop smoke and you drop it right on our position. And we're all going down together. We're all going to die. And I honestly believe he has that same mentality. He's very rational. He'll make compromises where he needs to. But if we ever push him to the wall, we better not imagine that somehow he's going to roll over. This is not a Robert McNamara. This is not a Ted Kennedy. This is not one of these guys who says, what's in it for me? This is a guy who is going to say, if I am the last president of Russia, I am going to be the president who said, you're not taking us down without going down yourselves.
Do you think that if that happens or we start to invade Russia, do you think that the fight would come to our land? I mean, they clearly yeah. have the ability to do that.
Well, right now, there are a lot more nuclear weapons that are active than there are operational, ready to go. As near as I can tell, the United States and Russia each have about 1,500 nuclear warheads of various sizes that are ready to go. You know, if the balloon goes up today, you can fire. The others are in various states of repair or disrepair. But if you have an exchange of 3,000 nuclear weapons, and you never know whether other countries get drawn into it, some of them, you know, Israel has 600 nuclear weapons. Pakistan has, I don't know how many nuclear mm-hmm. weapons. Russia or China has some. But even if you just look at the United States and Russia, you're talking about a massive destruction of humanity. These are weapons that are far more than the weapons used at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Some of them maybe 100 times, or 200 times that force. You're going to see potentially the annihilation of the major portion of all of the human race on Earth. And so I really believe that it is incumbent on the president to draw back from this and to say, look, the only vital security interest that the United States has in Russia is avoiding a nuclear war. All of the other is trivial pursuit.
Absolutely.
How many people have you heard say, oh my gosh, you know what happened the other day? The Crimeans voted to be part of Russia, and that is hurting my cousin and my brother, and
exactly.
I'm going to lose my job because, no, it doesn't affect anybody. It
makes no sense.
No effect whatsoever on the United States. It's purely a construct of NATO and of these global oligarchs who benefit from the sales of weapons, manipulating the oil markets, the sales of drugs, and the major drug traffic. So we better stop it. And I think it's shows like yours where people get to hear what's really going on. Because, it's really stunning. The more, I had my doubts about WikiLeaks when it first came out. And then I started reading what they were publishing. Mm-hmm. And I thought, my gosh, if it weren't for WikiLeaks, none of us would have a clue.
It is so important.
What's happening?
It is so important, the stuff they're doing. And now there's a formal arrest warrant, apparently. The United States is trying to step up its attack on WikiLeaks. I don't know.
And it emanates from the CIA, you see. And the CIA, one of their jobs is when we go to war, they are the ones who lay in place the rationale for war. And it happened before the CIA. When I was a little boy, children knew that when the battleship Maine was sunk in Havana Harbor by the Spanish, allegedly, the Spanish who were still using sail ships, wooden hulled sail ships with cannon where you ram the cannonballs down. And here they've got a modern battleship and they decide to sink it. Children understood there was no motive. And now Americans have been so indoctrinated, we don't understand. Anytime there's an allegation, you have to look for a motive. This is what attorneys do. If you go to law school, you're going to be taught, look for the motive, establish the motive, lay that out for the jury, and then you can prove your case. There was no motive to sink the Maine. It was an automatic destruction of the Spanish Empire. Why would they do it? They wouldn't do it. And it didn't happen. You can go all through our history, but now the CIA is formally the go-to people to say that Saddam Hussein of Iraq had sarin gas. We really like sarin gas, by the way. if sarin gas seems spooky, and people seem to really glom onto it, so we use it all the time. Colin Powell, when he was, he went up to the United Nations and he held a little test tube and he's talking about Iraq has sarin gas and this much sarin gas could destroy so much. Well, it was a farce. They had no sarin gas and we went in and we killed 100,000 Iraqis.
Know. That's just unbelievable.
It is. Do you know, this is the 27th anniversary of when the United States first began attacking Iraq. We have dropped 250,000 bombs over the span of 27 years. For what?
We don't
A country
stop.
that never attacked us, never took any aggressive action, never harbored terrorists. And here we are, and there's no end in sight.
But, you know, there is a cost more than people are realizing. And I did a show a while ago of the suicides that are going on in our military. And we have, according to government numbers, we have 21 people a day, veterans, that are killing themselves. And people in the circles think that it's actually higher. And they're, you know, government numbers are usually not all that accurate. But according to government numbers, we have already surpassed in one decade, which, you know, it's been going on for a long time, surpass Vietnam War losses in with veteran suicides. I charted this all out. And 15 years worth, we're already passing World War I losses. People who died in military combat during the Vietnam War, or people who died in military combat during the World War I, we have surpassed that when you count up the number of suicides. And people don't realize how much it's affecting our people. War has consequences.
Oh, it does. I remember many years ago when we were talking about adopting the all-volunteer armed forces. I was on active duty, and I really wanted it. I wanted to, you know, professionalize and so forth. And I've always remembered something that Charlie Rangel of New York, Democrat liberal of New York, said. He said, we need to keep the draft because it gives us this loop, this feedback loop.
It's a balance of power.
You send people over, they say, wow, this is really stupid. And they come back, and because they're not professional, because they aren't silenced, all of a sudden they become very vocal, and they begin putting pressure.
Yes.
And I've been a little bit haunted by that. The moment he said it, I knew it was true, but I really wanted the all-volunteer armed force. And I look back now and I think, how long ago would we have wrapped up things? Do you know
it's so important.
The Algerians fought for 8 years in the French fought for 8 years in Algeria until finally it just got to be too much. They had to pull out. And it was because the people basically said, enough, we just can't fight forever. We have been fighting in Afghanistan since 2001.
I know that, yeah.
We've been fighting twice as long as the French fought in Algeria. And you know with absolute certainty that the day we pull out, the government collapses, because we fund something like 96% of the entire government, all of their public works, all of their civil servants, all of their military. It's all American funded. It's a facade. And so at a certain point, you have to say, okay, we don't like the way their culture is. We don't like the way they treat women. We don't like the way they treat minority religions. But it is not our country. And at some point, you got to say, you know what? We're bankrupting ourselves doing this. And we are. We're bankrupting ourselves all over the world.
And you know as well as I do, the best way to get somebody to change is to bypass them culturally and just thrive while they aren't, because they're acting that way. They're oppressing their people. And whenever you have oppression in mass amounts in a culture, the whole country is going to be held back. And so if we can thrive, they will want part of that. The younger generations, people want part of that. It's as long as there's freedom and free trade and things. But we, with what we're doing, we're not thriving because we're bankrupting ourselves and we're doing things to our armed forces. We're doing all these things. We're hurting ourselves to a level that it's going to have decades of ramifications.
Well, it really is. It has hurt this country very much. We have been in a perpetual state of war. In the First World War, they used to say, this is the war to end all wars. And then, You know, at the end of the Second World War, there was, okay, you know, peace, you know, we've got peace. Nobody talks about peace. Nobody talks about the end of the war. They've come up with this phrase, the long war, which means it's not their intention to ever end this war.
That's why we need the draft. That's why we need, and nobody wants it. Nobody wants the draft, right? It's not going to be, it's the hurdle to bring the draft would be so hard. But that's the only thing that will end the war.
It would end the war. I'm not necessarily advocating the draft. It just, there's so many difficulties. I'm just saying that I know. Now that we made a very grave mistake when we did away with it, because, as you know, we weren't nearly as disciplined, we weren't nearly as orderly, but we had young kids who could come back and walk down the street and people would say, "Hey, what's happening in Afghanistan?" They'd say, "You wouldn't believe how stupid we are over there, and we're fighting for nothing." And here, you know, we send highly disciplined professionals over there. Their families, their careers are at stake. They can't speak out, but they're saying the same things privately.
Yes, they are. So, you know, I'm going to ask a sad question. Does the human race need a big war every so often to cleanse itself emotionally and to start over? It's a terrible question. It's a terrible thing to think about. But is it true? I kind of put you on the spot.
I don't think so. You know, we would be completely cleansed by now if that were the case. We have been at war for so many years. I mean, you go back to the year 2001. There hasn't been a time that we haven't been at war. I was reading about Iran, and of course, Iran, you know, they've got their problems. Don't get me wrong, but they have never been expansionist, and the things that we call terrorism. Well, when we went into Iraq, which was right next door to them, sure, they funneled weapons over and they tried to do what they could to kick us out. Why? Because they were next. If China came into Mexico, you think we would not be funneling weapons to the Mexican revolutionaries? Of course. So, and they keep repeating this thing, well, Iran is the major source of terrorism. And I ask, give me an example. And they say, oh, well, you know, decades ago, they were involved in the bombing of the Marine barracks in Lebanon. All right. Okay. Maybe they were. And I hate to look, I was a Marine. I hate to see Marines. I love the service people. I hate to see them hurt. But the question would be, well, what were we doing with Marines in Lebanon? What business did we have with Marines in Lebanon? And I think if you look at Iran over the last 1,000 years, their foreign policy has been keep people away from us, keep them from getting to our borders, but they're not out trying to enlarge the country, take over place, not like Turkey. Turkey is trying to enlarge, trying to sever off pieces of this country. Now they're starting to make noises that they think they ought to have more of Greece than they got back in the Treaty of 1923. They're our allies, the people who are expansionists, who are aggressive, who are nasty dictators. Iran, are they trying to get nuclear weapons? Maybe they are. But I don't think they're trying to take over the world. I feel much more threatened by Turkey today and by Saudi Arabia today than I do by Russia or Iran today. Because Saudi Arabia is planting Wahhabism all around the globe. Wahhabism is the most fundamental, vicious form of Islam. There are a lot of places where Islam is practiced and, you know, people get along, but they're radicalizing people all over the world. And then you look at Turkey, And they have just done a referendum that has made Turkey the new Hitler. He has absolute power over everything. He can appoint the majority of their high court. He can decide who can run for parliament. He can dissolve all of parliament if he wants. He can declare a state of emergency and nobody has any oversight. The other day, he just threw 1,000 people in jail because they were known to have liked Gulen, who was a Turkish fellow who's living, I think, up in Pennsylvania. And because they liked him, well, put him in jail, you know, let him rot away in jail. This man is the modern day Hitler, and he is the greatest danger to the West, to Western civilization. But he's our good ally.
Yeah, he's our ally, and we're fighting with him.
Well, we're committed by a treaty under NATO. If he feels attacked, American kids are supposed to go out and fight for these stinkers under this dictator. And it wasn't, but it was 3 or 4 years ago, there were a number of articles where U.S. Navy ships were putting into port in Turkey, and Turkish gangs were running them down and beating them up in town because they were Christians and because they were Americans. It didn't get front pages of the New York Times, but it was widely published. These are the people that we're allied with. Nobody ever was running around beating up Americans in Syria. Syria was one of the five safest nations on earth before we decided we were going to overthrow them.
We took something great and we decided we're going to do something bad. Now, what's going on with North Korea? Because weird.
Yeah, I'm not nearly the expert on North Korea. I think North Korea has existed as a pirate nation. They produce very little of value. And so what they do is they pump all of their money into nuclear weapons. And every 2-3 years, they threaten everybody. And everybody runs in and gives them a whole lot of stuff. And then they're quiet for a few years. And then they do it again. To me, it's a little reminiscent of the Barbary Pirates. We fought a war, I don't know, what, 1829, somewhere around there. And we had a major part of the U.S. budget had gone to paying tribute to the pirates in Tripoli, which was the area along Libya, Tunisia in there. And finally, we got sick of it and said, you know what, we're going to send troops and we're going to put an end to it. And so we sent Lieutenant Presley O'Bannon of the United States Marine Corps and a number of naval ships and naval troops. And we took them down. And I hope that this is sort of a parallel to what's going on in North Korea right now.
Yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, Trump said that we really could have a conflict with North Korea. Like we could go in there. But I think that sounded more like a threat versus something that was real.
Okay, this is complex because you sort of have to read from what you can see on the surface. I think what's happening, I think that that Donald Trump has worked out favorable arrangements with China. China cut off the importation of coal from North Korea, which was a very major step. They are definitely helping to put pressure on North Korea to take a more reasonable stance. So I think the U.S. and China are allied to a certain extent. I just hope that we aren't trading our position relative to trade agreements with China in exchange for help with North Korea. North Korea is not the biggest thing on Trump's plate. It's always there. It's always been around. I don't know. Eventually, it'll disappear. It is true that they do have nuclear weapons. And whether they would use, I mean, if the moment that they used a nuclear weapon, all life would cease to exist in North Korea. So as crazy as they are, and I mean, they are a little off the edge, I have to question whether they would be willing to simply see the annihilation of all mankind on the Korean, North Korean part of the peninsula. So I hope we haven't given up too much to get what we're getting. We are making progress. It seems to be handled reasonably well from an outsider's perspective, which is really where I am right now. I like the phrase when Mike Pence said that the time of strategic patience is over, or whatever. That was the essence of what he said. But we will see where it all ends up. If I were to predict, my guess is that we will see tensions drop and there will be some benefit flowing to North Korea, that they will get some stuff from somebody somewhere, maybe it's from the Chinese, and they will go back to sleep for a while. I don't know where it'll end up, but...
And we kind of rely on China, right? I mean, with that situation, China really is the one who can lead.
They have the most at stake. You know, if North Korea were to collapse, they would have a tremendous exodus of refugees, which they don't want. They literally have Chinese troops on the border to stop refugees from coming over. The other thing is, it's a little bit like NATO with the fall of the Berlin Wall. Just like the fall of the Berlin Wall, we suddenly had this big buffer. The reason that the Chinese came into the Korean War was because the United States forces went all the way up to the Yellow River. And all of a sudden, we were right on the border with China, and that was very threatening to them. And as a consequence of our lack of foresight, what we could have done is we could have gone a little bit into the north, where we created an area around Seoul, Korea. Now, Seoul, Korea, which is the capital of South Korea, is right on the border. So it's created a very awkward situation. Ideally, in retrospect, what we would have done is when we were pushing the North Koreans back very rapidly, we would have sent a message to China and said, look, we have no interest in approaching the Chinese border. We are simply going to form an area around Seoul, Korea that gives us a buffer from attacks. And I think we would have settled the Korean War without half of the casualties we took. And I think China would have said, all right, if they don't come any farther beyond there, we'll be okay. But if they do, we're coming in. We need to recognize even today that whatever we do needs to include assurances to China that we are not expanding Korea from the south all the way to the Yellow River, that we have no interest in reuniting Korea, that if anything, we wouldn't mind seeing a border adjustment so that we stabilize things, and then start trade between South Korea and North Korea and China and North Korea, make them a normal country again, but get away from this idea of nuclear blackmail, becoming essentially nuclear pirates. That's what they are.
It's not helpful for anybody, but it would be nice for them to become a normal country for their people. Their people are pretty messed up when you see the secret filming and things that are going on in there.
Well, their people are tortured. I mean, they're treated like animals in North Korea. So, but, you know, I'm beyond the point where I'm interested in solving everybody's problem all around the globe. There are people who are mistreated, and there's corruption out there. And we often say, oh, well, such and such is corrupt. Are we not a corrupt country?
Exactly. Yes.
I mean, seriously.
Yes. Well, and that's why it bothers me that we would go to war when, as awful as it was, the 80 people that they claimed, the Syrian gas, you know, Syrians gassed their own people, 80 people died. As awful as that is, the fact that we would use that as a basis to go to war makes no sense to me. You know, no. We're already in war, but no. You know what I'm saying. When there's thousands of people dying all over the place for all sorts of really nefarious reasons.
A week after that, there had been an agreement between the Syrian government and the Qatari government representing all of the terrorists. The terrorists had besieged a pro-government area, and the Syrian government had a rebel area under siege. They agreed to a swap, and they brought, you know, commercial buses to each place. The Syrian government has a pristine record of always observing these treaties scrupulously when it talks about exchanges driving these buses. On the other hand, the terrorist murdered 126 people, including many, many children, by putting IEDs where they knew they were going to kill helpless, disarmed civilians, and it didn't even make the front pages of the newspapers. They killed more people than died at Khan Shaykhun the week before. And, what the heck? It's just Syrian people. It's not terrorists. We love the terrorists. The terrorists are our guys. We are totally allied with Al-Qaeda, the group that brought down the Twin Towers. The United States has been on their side as their allies ever since around 2010, 2011. And it's bizarre. It is suicidal, and it's bankrupting the nation. It is corrupting us. I mean, it's morally so decadent, the idea that we would be on the side of the people who brought about the deaths of more Americans in an attack on the American mainland than any time in the history of the United States.
So you being so close to Washington, D.C., you're a state senator in Virginia. How much influence is it? It's a unique position, being so close to Washington, D.C. Do you get involved in any of those, that kind of politics for foreign policy? Can you, do you have access to that now?
Yes, in a couple of different ways. One is that I'm a fairly respected voice in foreign affairs, and so I'm able to articulate things in a way that people can understand them. And I've studied enough to where, I've got a very clear picture of what's going on in certain areas. I get invited to different embassies, and you know, I spend time at the Pakistani embassy. When President El-Sisi of Egypt came, I addressed members of parliament from that delegation. I'm a great fan of President El-Sisi, by the way. I think he's pushing the envelope about as far as he can reasonably do in that country. So I keep up a lot of relations with people who are in the Middle East, and I think just perhaps give hope to people that there are a number of people who are anti-war for very good reasons, but there are very few people who have experienced extremely bitter, fierce fighting like I have, who are saying what we're doing is wrong. So it brings a certain air of credibility to it. Obviously, I'm constantly putting my position as a senator on the line, because There are people who disagree with it, and that's just the way it is. To me, I have a picture. There's a briefing that I give, and it's a slide briefing. And the last slide I bring up is a photograph that was taken at a cathedral, a Christian cathedral in Damascus, and there's a school beside it. And they brought together all of the children. They're teenagers. They're older teenagers. And so we all took a picture together, and boys and girls, and they all just have a look, a sort of a glow of youthful joy and happiness about them. And I usually close by saying, a lot of people ask, you don't have any relatives in Syria. Why are you so passionate about it? And I say, if you look in the faces, look across the faces of the people on this slide, if the United States succeeds in toppling Syria in the next 2 years, all of those people will be dead. All of the children in that photograph will be dead.
And that's
maybe
what
some
they...
of the women will be sex slaves. The children will be raped, but they, all of them will be destroyed. And so this is why I am so passionate about it, and why I'm willing to risk everything.
About 4 million, right? Stuff. You're estimating about 4 million people.
Yes, 2 million Christians, 2 million Alawites. And then there would be others also. There would be the Sunni Muslims who have cooperated with the government. Many of them would die. This would be one of the biggest bloodlettings in history, and it would not happen without the United States being actively involved. We now train terrorists in Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. We arm them, we pay the salaries of some of them, and then we send them across the Syrian border, where they go and they rape, they murder, they annihilate Christian villages. And this is being done under a CIA program known as Timber Sycamore. It was highly classified. Now it's thanks to our good friends at WikiLeaks, we know about it. And I just recently found out the name of it. I knew that it existed because I put together pieces over 6 years. When the Russians sent their expeditionary force in, the Syrian army immediately began rolling back the terrorists. If the United States had not rushed TOW anti-tank missiles to all of the terrorists, to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, all of these different terrorist groups, that war would have been over by now. Refugees would be returning. The nation would be rebuilding. There would be joy. There would be happiness. People would be rebuilding their lives. But we made a decision in the White House to rush TOW anti-tank missiles, which blunted the force of the Syrian attack. And we're still doing it. And we could still end that war with a decision of the president. If the president sent out a memo and it said, by virtue of this executive order, any person who assists any rebel group in Syria will be terminated immediately. Every organization within the federal government will work to assist the Syrian government in restoring its integrity and defeating all rebel groups, no matter what their designation, who they are called, without specific exceptions granted by the White House. We would end that war in no time at all. It would be over.
That's why I was wondering what courage needed to be, or who's putting the pick in Trump's side and changing his there's an internal debate and struggle going on that caused him to take a 180. Go ahead.
All the foreign policy conservatives are being purged, and it began with Michael Flynn. Michael Flynn was perhaps the most important member of the entire cabinet. He knew where all the skeletons were buried. He knew right from wrong. He knew how to end the war, and he was purged. You know, they came up with some concoction to get rid of him. Now, you know, just one by one, you know, Katie McFarland went, and then, you know, a whole variety of them are being pushed out of influential positions. And in their place, neocons who have run this war for decades. And I wish every neocon had to go to Walter Reed Hospital like I do and walk around and see young, strong, vibrant guys with their legs missing up to their hips being strolled around, their entire lives destroyed. And then I'd like to say, okay, your children are going to be put in the front lines in the infantry. They're going to be making patrols in Afghanistan. And so if you like it so much, your kids, your sons, your daughters are going, they're going to go anonymously. Nobody's going to know that it's a senator, it's a congressman, it's a White House official. They're going to go, and just be aware that you may have to care for them for the rest of their lives, because they may come back without legs, without arms, blinded, burned to a crisp, to where their whole life, they got to get an operation every month because their skin is tightening up. If they understood the real price, but instead they rake in money.
Well, and the real price mentally too, the fact that we're having so many soldiers die from killing themselves, and for every soldier that doesn't commit suicide, the torture that they have inside of being able to mentally deal with what they had to do and witness. It's
And, you know, I look back on Vietnam. I have no regrets, but I tell you, if someone told me you have to attack Syria, I would carry that to the grave with me, because I would know that I had been killing innocent people to benefit the most vile, evil, satanic people on the globe. And that would, you know, that would bother me.
And I think that's what's going on. I think that's why there's so many people just really struggling. Well, how can people learn more about you and reach you and support you? And you're such a refreshing voice out there that's sharing the truth and getting this stuff out there and educating people. And people need to understand what's really going on and where our tax dollars are going and what the ramifications are.
The easiest way is to go to senatorblack.com and just look that up. You'll get my website at senatorblack.com, and that will link you up to our everything that we send out on Twitter, on Facebook, and you can sign up for Facebook. You can sign up for Twitter. Usually, we try to make our Facebook more of a local thing because we use it when we campaign. But the Twitter, we have Twitter all over the world. We have tens of thousands of people on Twitter, and they watch it because I tell you, if you read the mainstream media, you do not have a clue what the truth is. Not the faintest hint of what the truth is.
That's exactly right. That is right. And that's not a good... It's not good commentary. We need to change that in order for our country to move forward. But thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you so much for your service to the country and everything that you do.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed being with you. And I appreciate all that you're doing. It's the alternative media. It's the internet. This is really the only way that we're able to compete. And surprisingly, we do a pretty good job of it. Thank you so much. God bless.
And that's all we have today, folks. I hope you have an amazing weekend, and we'll be back on Monday with a new episode of Business Game Changers. Until then, have a great day.